This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Republicans in the Wisconsin state legislature introduced a new package of proposals last week aimed at addressing what's been called a child care crisis here in the state. This comes after the legislature had rejected Governor Evers' proposal to use state surplus funds to extend child care counts, a pandemic-era program set to expire early next year. Critics of the proposed package of legislation say it wouldn't do enough to address the concerns of families or child care providers who have been overwhelmed with demand as parents return to working in person after the peak of the pandemic. But the bill's authors say the solutions they're proposing should get bipartisan support. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent, what are your experiences finding child care in Wisconsin? Did you find some? Was it affordable? Do you work as a child care provider? What kind of things would make the most difference for you in new child care legislation from the state? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our next guests are Republican Assembly representatives and co-creators of these new proposals. Representative Joy Gobin represents District 5 in northeastern Wisconsin. Representative Gobin, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And Representative Karen Hurd represents District 68, just east of Eau Claire. Representative Hurd, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
There's a variety of things on the table here. Representative Gobin, first of all, can you talk about the parts of these proposals that would make childcare more accessible, that would change who can work, for example, in childcare, things like that?
Okay, well, my portion is I have five different bills. All of them are sort of geared toward accessibility. We have one bill has the state allows certified providers, but those certified providers are only being allowed to watch sort of half of what they do because half of their children that they can watch, they have up to six. Three of them can be related and three unrelated. And so this bill says they can watch six kids whether or not they are related. So it seems sort of common sense. Not sure why that was adopted to be as it is, but let's open up so that they can care for the full amount of children that their certification allows. We also have the creation of a new type of child care center, the large family child care center. I ran a family child care center. It's run in your home, and you can have up to eight children. But the large family center says I can have an employee, and now I can have up to 12 children in my home child care center. Both of those would allow for some increased spots for child care, which is a great way to do it. We also have a bill about assistant child care teachers that young people, 16, can now count in the ratios if they have the education requirements. So we're not just putting anybody in there. They need to be, they need to have the coursework in early child care so that they can count in the ratios. This is good for child care centers because, so for example, you could have an apprenticeship, which would be a 16-year-old, but a child care center isn't going to have an apprentice that doesn't count in their numbers because then they're paying someone to not help have more children. So that's another option there. Let's see, what else? We are adjusting the ratios slightly to try to make it allow more flexibility for centers in their ratios to create more spots, hopefully provide more income to child care workers.
And Representative Hurd, another piece on the table here is the idea of a loan fund for some local providers. What would we see there?
What we have is a 0% loan. So a child care center could apply for one of these 0% loans, and then it's a revolving loan. So if they pay it back, then we could offer the loan to others. We're going to put 60%, given that the bill goes through, of course, we're going to require 60% of the 15 million. So if 15 million is what we're allocating, that 60% would go to in-home providers and 40% going to the centers. That would mean 300 family in-home facilities could get a $30,000 0% interest loan. And 60 of the larger child care facilities could get $100,000 as 0% interest free loan. It's really would be great. So if you're thinking about, oh, I would like to, you know, have in my house a child care center, but I have to have a fence. well, then you could use this 0% loan to get the fence and get that in, or whatever is needed to make your home a child care facility.
I want to ask each of you what you're hearing from constituents, those looking for child care, those providing it. Representative Gobin, as you talk to people, what are you hearing?
I'm hearing there is a need for help in creating sustainable child care. There are not enough slots. I just spoke to someone from my district who is a district administrator of the Hobart area, and he was talking to a child care provider who said they're going to go out of business. But the reasoning is a little different than what some people are talking about, and it has to do with 4K. So the 4K, which there's a school right near that area, and they aren't able to the 4K takes off the four-year-olds. That makes it a lot harder because of ratios for that provider to make a living. So she's concerned that her center isn't going to be able to stay open or sustain it if they, for example, take 3K. So there's a drought of childcare, and we need to find ways to make it more accessible.
And how about in your part of the state, Representative Hurd?
It's the same. That, you know, we're short, looking for slots for childcare. But these bills, I think, will really help out. As I've spoken to people in the area, they're very much excited about them. And they're not seeing as much of the child care closures as we thought that we were going to see. And so it's actually a very good thing. I think this is going to bring a lot of solutions to the people.
Representative Gobin, we've seen some criticism in the child care community and from your Democratic colleagues in the legislature that in effect, you're deregulating. You're changing the provider to kid ratio. You're loosening things up, and it's going to maybe threaten quality in childcare. What do you say to those concerns?
I think that's unfair. When we look at other states, we are in line with other states, and we've actually tried to find out, are these other states, you know, having issues in quality, and we don't see that. Also, something to consider is that no one is forcing a child care to change their ratios. It's an option for flexibility. So whether or not they have, depending on the type of quality employees that they have, maybe these ratio changes are going to be great. Maybe they need to hold, for whatever reasons, to the ratios that they have now. It's offering, we're trying to offer flexibility, and that's what I think these bills do.
And finally, Representative Hurd, I mentioned Governor Evers had proposed using state budget surplus funding to keep this federal thing going. Do you see maybe of the Child Care Counts program, do you see a way to meet halfway, do some of what he was hoping for in his initial budget, get some of what you and your colleagues are hoping for in this package of proposals?
Well, we had, you know, Governor Evers, we had put this child care renovations loan in the original budget, and then Governor Evers vetoed out that it wouldn't be a loan program. It would just be to a child care fund. So basically to backfill that child care counts program. But we're putting back in the loan program because it actually be more helpful, because it will give people more money. It keeps going back to the child care facilities. We don't run out of money and then, you know, we reach this cliff. We need to fix the whole broken system. This system in childcare, it was broken long, long before COVID. And, you know, I've got the data going way back into the 80s, how this all occurred. And just even in 2013, before COVID, I mean, they were losing 200 to 400 childcare facilities a year because the model's broken. And that's what these bills are trying to address, is to fix the broken childcare business model so that it can sustain itself and doesn't need to have subsidiaries from the government being handed out, because that's not sustainable and it doesn't fix the problem. It's just a band-aid to the problem. We need to fix the cause.
We'll leave it there.
May I add to that?
Briefly, yes, go ahead.
Just a note that our budget did spend $93 million on child care. So there were increases in the SHARES program, reaching out to those who have affordability issues. So there is a considerable amount of money coming from the state to different programs for child care.
Right. And it was $93 million all new money this budget. Overall, total spend in this biennial budget is $960 million in child care.
Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Republican Assembly Representative Joy Gobin and Karen Hurd about the new package of child care proposals introduced in the Wisconsin State Legislature. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert in child care programs. Alejandra Ross-Pilars is assistant professor in the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at UW-Madison. Alejandra, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alejandra, what are you seeing in the child care landscape? How big are the challenges?
Yeah, so as Representative Hurd said, the childcare system has been broken for many, many years, even before the pandemic. But the COVID pandemic really exacerbated already existing challenges. So let me explain. So on the one hand, many parents cannot access high quality early care and education. Even before the pandemic, there was a shortage of regulated childcare providers that parents could get to within a reasonable driving distance. But even when parents have childcare near their home, many can't afford the cost of it, which is as much as $13,500 per infant in a childcare center. And those who can afford the childcare are spending about 20% of their budget on average on childcare. So this puts a big strain on families' budgets. During the pandemic, we've seen childcare costs, especially in recent months, go up for families, and the price is rising more quickly than for other goods and services. So parents are having a hard time. And then the second key thing to know is that childcare workers are highly educated and highly trained workers, but are extremely undercompensated given their education and skills. So when the COVID pandemic started, many centers closed, family childcare providers closed, some permanently, some temporarily. Childcare workers, some of them lost their jobs, some of them went to work in other sectors for higher pay. So the childcare industry has not fully recovered. Even today, we're short about 40,000 workers compared to before the pandemic nationally. So part of the reason that the sector is struggling so much in retaining workers is because they are so undercompensated. So for example, in Wisconsin, childcare workers, most of them have more than a high school education, an associate's degree or bachelor's degree, but are making only $13 an hour. That's $3 less than the average worker with only a high school education. So they are extremely undercompensated, and that makes it really difficult to keep them in the sector when they can earn a higher wage in other industries. There's substantial turnover in the sector. It makes it difficult for childcare providers to staff their childcare centers and family childcare homes. So things are challenging as it is, and the Childcare Counts program really is keeping the sector afloat. This is funded with pandemic relief funds, which are set to expire in 2024. And so the concern is that things are already and sort of precarious in the sector as it is. And when those funds expire, childcare providers are using those funds right now to pay their workers more without raising prices for parents. And so when those funds expire, workers might leave for other sectors because compensation will go down, or providers will close, or parents will end up paying more for care. So those are sort of the current state of what's happening in the sector. And that's why we really need more investments of funding into the sector to fix the broken financing.
We're talking to Alejandra Ross-Pilars, assistant professor in the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at UW-Madison, looking at the challenges facing childcare here in the state, possible policy solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the legislation we heard from a pair of state lawmakers a little while ago? Do you work in childcare? What would help you the most if you're a parent having trouble finding childcare? You can we'll get to or afford. Love to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Alejandra Ross-Pilars, assistant professor of social work at UW-Madison, looking at the latest package of child care bills proposed by Republicans in the Wisconsin state legislature and how they fit into bigger trends we're seeing around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Alejandra, picking up where you left off, child care costs a lot for parents. The people providing it don't make a lot of money doing it. Apart from putting state or federal money into it, are there changes that could make the industry more sustainable?
The key thing really is fixing this funding issue. And the research shows that what is effective for shoring up the childcare sector is, one, increasing compensation for workers. So we have research that shows that providing financial incentives to stay in the sector, increasing compensation, is going to reduce turnover and allow workers to stay in the sector and not leave for other higher paying jobs. And so right now, funding from childcare accounts is being used to allow childcare workers to receive a stipend of up to $1,900 per year. That would, you know, that's on top of what their wages are from their childcare center or family childcare home. And so that, again, would have to be reduced or go away entirely once the funding runs out. And so we know those things are really effective at reducing turnover, at keeping workers in the sector. And then the second key thing that we know from the research is that increasing funding for childcare, for example, through the childcare subsidy program, would have big effects on reducing out-of-pocket costs for parents, would increase employment among mothers, and would increase wages by providers for up to 30%. So those are the things that we know from the research that are effective at helping the childcare sector, you know, be stronger and have parents be able to access high quality care.
We got an email from Leah who writes, "My husband and I have been on wait lists since April, and we might get into full-time childcare by February of next year, which is causing lots of issues with our employment." This is in South Central Wisconsin, Leah writes. So not just unaffordable childcare, Alejandra, but not able to get into childcare, period. Do we have places in the state where even if you can't afford it, you can't find childcare?
Definitely. So, you know, the access to care really varies a lot across the state. What we know is that a number of slots per child is better in urban areas. So there's a 1.7 children per childcare slot in urban areas compared to about 3.4 in rural areas. So there are places in that it's a little bit easier. That said, it's much harder to find care for infants and toddlers. And part of the reason for that is it's more expensive. It's both for parents, but also for childcare centers to provide that care. And so they don't make as much, you know, per child, because you need small ratios in order for that care to be safe and high quality. And so finding infant and toddler care is a challenge across the state. You just heard that a lot from parents, and there are long wait lists, especially for those younger kids.
In that package of new legislation I was talking to state lawmakers about, they would change the standards, allow a little change to staff to student ratio that they say other states are already doing, making it easier for younger people to get involved in childcare. Do you think changes like that could help solve the problem?
Yeah, fundamentally, what we need is increased investment in the sector. It's hard to know exactly whether those what effects that those proposed changes would have. What we do know is that you know, it's unclear if providers would actually change their ratios to have more kids per staff. There are many centers are accredited by national organizations that have these lower ratios, and so increasing their ratios would put them out of accreditation. It might cause them to lose their quality rating in the Young Star system, which is the statewide system that provides ratings to childcare providers so that parents know what quality care they're getting. So if they increase their ratios, you know, they might not be able to, or they might face unintended consequences from that. The other key thing about that is that, you know, childcare workers, as I said, are already undercompensated. They experience high burnout. And so you would be adding more to their plate, having them care for more children, bigger group sizes. And so it's not clear that, you know, this might have, you know, an adverse effect on increasing turnover if workers are just burnt out and decide that, you know, if they're not getting compensated more for doing more work, that they will, you know, just decide to leave for other higher paying jobs that are less burdensome.
Alejandra, we've talked about the impact on parents, the impact on childcare providers. How about kids? What do we know about access to quality childcare programs and what it means for kids as they grow up?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. We know a good amount about this question. And so the research on this is very clear. There's a wealth of evidence that high quality and affordable early care and education promotes children's development. There's benefits both in the short term to their learning and, in preschool, in kindergarten, in early years, and longer term, children who attend high quality early care education also do have a higher educational attainment. They more likely graduate college, they have higher earnings, and they're healthier as adults. So all of these things are, obviously great benefits for kids, for them in the long run, but also for society, because society also reaps benefits from having a healthier and more educated workforce down the line. So this is really an area where we know if we make these investments when kids are young, we will reap the benefits down the line as a society. So it's really an issue that is important for all of us, not just those with young kids, but for everyone who will benefit from this down the road.
Alejandra, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Alejandra Ross-Pilars is an assistant professor in the Sandra Rosenbaum School of Social Work at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She joined us for a closer look at new legislation that proposes to address gaps in Wisconsin's child care system. Earlier, we heard from two state lawmakers, Joy Goban and Karen Hurd, both Republicans in the Assembly. They have a package of legislation aimed at tackling at least part of this problem. You can read more about that online at WPR.org. Our news team has been covering that. And if this is something that affects your life, there is still time for you to weigh in. You could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Did you have success in finding childcare? Was it childcare you pay for or something you worked with a family member on, maybe? That's parents. How about caregivers? Do you work as a childcare provider or run some kind of childcare, big or small? Love to hear what you're seeing and what you think might help you and your situation. As always, you could email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Love to see your stories. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, find out how our plastic recycling system works. It can be confusing. Does this go in? Does this not? And get advice on how we can do it more efficiently and effectively by changing the system. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Sure, you could send a message in a bottle, but how about a message in an egg carton? This has been making its way through the news, initially reported, as far as I can tell, by KCCI News in Des Moines, Iowa. Back in 1951, a young woman packing eggs into cartons wrote a note on one of them with her name and city and the message, "Whoever gets this egg, please write." She got her wish last month, 70 plus years later. The egg went to New York City. The buyer kept it as a curiosity. For reasons I don't fully understand, it didn't rot. It just sort of petrified. He gave it to a neighbor. The neighbor posted on a Facebook site this summer. Word spread, and yes, the current owner of the egg made contact 7 decades later with a now 92-year-old woman who wrote the note. I think I speak for everybody when I say, please, don't eat that egg. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. The Human Genome Project released the first full sequence of a complete human gene 20 years ago. And along with the project came the potential for a new kind of medical treatment called personal medicine or precision medicine. The hope was that we could have unique treatments tailored to our genetic profiles. That hope came with a lot of hype. But our guest says, in reality, genetic differences have proven to be small factors in a lot of major illnesses, things like asthma or Parkinson's. And when personalized medicine has been effective, the cost for treatment can be ruinous for patients. But he says there's an even deeper problem. Funding has gone toward this kind of genetic medicine research and away from environmental causes of disease that could lead to more cost-effective prevention efforts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you familiar with this idea of personalized or precision medicine? Have you or someone you know or loved one had one of these treatments? Was it effective? Was it expensive? Do you have questions about the hopes for this medicine and what we might have lost in pursuing it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. James Tabry is a professor in the Department of Philosophy and member of the Center for Health Ethics, Arts, and Humanities at the University of Utah. His new book is called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, good to be with you.
I laid out the basics of the initial hopes for personalized medicine or precision medicine. Can you talk a little more about what we meant by those phrases at the outset?
Yeah, you nailed it. You know, the personalized medicine motto is the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. And it's really intentionally designed to be a contrast with what's often chided as the traditional one-size-fits-all approach to medicine. And so the idea is on traditional medicine, you know, if two patients have diabetes or if 1,000 patients have diabetes, they're all treated the same. But when we take the genomic differences between us into consideration, then that will no longer be the case. One patient with diabetes will get one treatment plan based on their particular genetic profile. Another patient will get a different one. And the promise there, the vision was that personalization, that ability to get down to the precise causes of problems was going to just sort of be a revolution across healthcare.
We'll get into some of the problems with the way that came out, but a really fundamental story in your book is your concern that this quest for these personalized medicines, these genomics-based medicines, took away from research into environmental health. Literally, at one point, basically two different pieces of research pitted against each other at the federal level. Can you talk about that aspect of the threat to public health that you see in personalized medicine?
Yeah, the thread that runs through the whole book is this story about two efforts that were undertaken at the U.S. National Institutes of Health. That's really the agency that's the crown jewel of biomedical research for the United States. And after the Human Genome Project wrapped up in 2003, there were two different efforts to try to launch a nationwide study of health in America. One of those was called the National Children's Study, and that was going to be an effort to recruit 100,000 children from across the United States. One of the first recruitment centers was actually going to be focused on Waukesha County in Wisconsin. It was very much going to be focused on the environmental contributions to health and illness, and basically tracking children from before they were born until they were adults, collecting all this information about the environmental exposures that they had, and then looking for how that contributed to who got sick and who didn't later in life. The other effort was, again, focused on collecting data from people all over the United States. That was going to be focused much more on genetic contributions to health and illness, getting blood, getting some basic measurements from folks at the beginning, and then just sort of looking to see who gets sick later in life and then hook up those genetic differences with the differences in health outcomes. And they were really in a kind of competition to see who was going to come to life. We can sort of dive into the details as much as you want later, but the long story short was in December 2014, the National Children's Study was ultimately terminated. And in January 2015, a month later, President Obama announced in his State of the Union address what came to be called the All of Us Research Project, and that was that genomics effort. So the book sort of looks at what were the factors, the financial factors, the social factors, the scientific factors, the technological factors that inclined the National Institutes of Health to lean in the direction of this genomic study rather than the environmental one. And the argument of the book is that these are forces that are all across the United States. And so, in fact, we're seeing something, a pivot towards genetics and healthcare generally.
Talking to James Tabry about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Will joins us now in Oconomowoc. Will, hi.
Hey there. My dad had prostate cancer and it metastasized to his liver. When that happened, they started personalizing his treatment based on his genetics, and I don't know very much about it. I experienced it as he was experiencing it, and he in the end passed away. So I don't know if it helped him or if it just prolonged kind of a downward spiral, but I'm really interested in the topic. Thanks.
And Will, actually, before I let you go, first, I'm sorry for the loss of your dad. Do you know, do you have any sense of how much it cost along the way, or were those things covered?
Cost was immense. I'm from California, and the state picked up a large portion of the bill because he's an older man. He passed away at 79, and he was retired, and I'm sure that his bills were a lot.
Will, thanks a lot for the call. And Jim, I know you can relate. You start your book with the story of your own father in Personalized Medicine.
Yeah, thanks so much for that call, Will. I had the exact same thought, Rob. The introductory chapter is basically my experience with this, and it was very similar to what Will just said, which was I encountered it by way of my father's experience with cancer. He was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer in 2011. He was given a drug, one of the early drugs that were really hailed as kind of one of these breakthrough treatments in personalized medicine. It was a drug called Tarceva for patients with lung cancer. For every indication, he did live a longer life. The life expectancy for somebody with stage 4 lung cancer at that time was about 8 months. My father was on Tarceva. He lived for about 13 months. So, as Will said, it was a lot of money. It did not cure him. It probably kept him around for a little while longer. In the end, I wish he didn't have lung cancer. And the story about the prevention of lung cancer is not one about the genes in our bodies. It's about making the air that we breathe more lung friendly, whether that's with smoking cessation programs or radon remission programs or asbestos abatement programs. The real progress in the downward trend of lung cancer diagnoses over the last few decades has not been genomic medicine. It's about making the environments that we live in much, much healthier.
Well, thanks a lot for sharing your story at 800-642-1234. Jim, some conditions that I think we had hopes for early on in genomic research were very common and growing problems like asthma and Parkinson's disease. As researchers tried to find genetic ties to those particular widespread conditions, what did they find?
That the genetics were far more complicated than they anticipated. I think it's helpful to contrast it. There certainly are conditions which are largely genetic in nature. There's a number of rare disorders, thinking about things like cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease, sickle cell, where the genetic cause of the problem, the basic mechanisms responsible for it, have long been known. Those have lent themselves to genetic interventions, and we can talk about that later. It creates different problems of economics, but at least the biological plausibility is there. When you shift to the conditions that are taking the largest toll on most people, you mentioned asthma, Parkinson's, diabetes, heart disease, a variety of cancers. Those things are, from a genetic perspective, enormously complicated. There's not just one or a handful of genes. In many cases, there's tens, dozens, hundreds, even thousands of regions in the genome that are implicated in those conditions, along with all sorts of environmental contributions. And so what happens with those far more complicated traits is it just becomes that much more difficult to get any sort of purchase that you could then use to develop some sort of personalized medicine. And in turn, the progress on those fronts has been far more limited than in contrast to things like cystic fibrosis and sickle cell disease.
So in the conclusion for your book, I think you're making the case pretty strongly that if we want to tackle something like asthma, probably funding gene research isn't going to help. What would you like to see targeted instead?
We're going to get the most bang for our buck out of making the environments that we live in safer. And that's both doing the research that identifies the things that are making us sick. It's also, and that's kind of traditional environmental research. Think of sort of, focus on toxins, air quality, which population of kids have access to what air. There's all sorts of research about different communities getting exposed to different environmental toxins. And so that's a part of that as well. The other side of it, of course, is also social behavioral research and research about intervention. So even though we know, city like Salt Lake City, where I live, the air quality is often very, very bad. But there's a big jump from recognizing that bad air quality is associated with a spike in asthma admittances into the hospital, and coming up with interventions that can then alter that problem. And so I think, you know, the focus has to be on making the environment safer and developing the resource so that we can navigate an environment that isn't always safe.
We're talking to Professor James Tabry from the University of Utah about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest based on what you've heard so far? What do you think about the idea of healthcare shifting to look more at our genetic profiles, moving away from environmental factors? Would you like to reverse that, as our guest would? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to James Tabry from the University of Utah. His new book is called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about the idea of personalized medicine, environmental public health efforts that may have been funded less because of the focus on genes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Jim, you mentioned earlier there are success stories where, yes, we're able to develop medications that work for people with more easily identifiable genetic causes of their conditions. But the costs, you write about that. Not only are they expensive to begin with, unlike a lot of medications, they seem to go up over time.
That's exactly right, Rob. The sort of poster child of personalized medicine was a drug called Gleevec. And it became the poster child in part because it was so successful and it came out quite early. So this was a drug that was approved by the FDA in 2001. That's right when the Human Genome Project is wrapping up. And so folks looking for, you know, something to point to as an example of this personalized medicine working were naturally drawn to Gleevec. It was a treatment for a particular form of blood cancer, for chronic myelogenous leukemia. About 5,000 to 10,000 people in the United States are diagnosed with it a year. And prior to 2001, life expectancy was quite poor. The chances of living more than 5 years after that diagnosis was very low. Now, when patients are diagnosed with chronic myelogenous leukemia, they can live for 10 or more years easily. And it's in part because of drugs like Gleevec and a series of others that have come along after it that are very effective at treating this cancer. But it came at a cost and in really frightening ways. When the drug was first approved, it cost about $2,000 to $3,000 a month. And so we're talking about $25,000 to $30,000 a year. And what happened was Novartis, the drug company that manufactured the drug, in the ensuing years, rather than having those costs come down as more and more patients were able to take it, and then in turn as more competitors came online to offer drugs that work similarly, the cost of it kept going up. And in fact, by the time that generics for Gleevec were finally available in 2016, the price of that drug had gone from about $20,000 to $30,000 a year to close to $150,000 a year. And there was this outcry from the chronic myelogenous leukemia patients and their families, as well as the researchers, saying that this is just unsustainable. And in fact, what we find is when you look across the board for these medications that are developed in this manner, they are oftentimes extremely expensive, sometimes in the millions of dollars, which creates all sort of access problems for the people who need it most.
Let's go back to our callers with Will in Madison. Will, hello.
Hi, hello. I have something that's concerning, connected to genetic research. Yes, I would like to participate in the genetic research of all of us knowing about it. However, I have not participated particularly in the genetic research because I have two parents who both had Alzheimer's and passed mm-hmm. with it. And my concern then is, what if that if I were to participate and that information were then exposed? Here is information potentially about me, and then it's made public. What does that do to my healthcare costs? What does that do to my insurance? Well, you know, it this is very concerning. Once we get into genetics, if this may potentially be my future.
Well, thanks for the call. Jim, what do you think?
That's a great question, Will, and thanks for being willing to share it. I think the first thing to say is back in 2008, the federal government did pass something called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act. And so, at least legally in theory, you cannot be discriminated against based on that genetic information when it comes to things like employment, housing, and health insurance. Now, there's sort of mixed reviews out there about how successful this is at protecting the people that need to be protected. But at least, again, in theory, the thought was we don't want people to be discriminated against based on that information. I think, though, the point that Will raises is a really important one, particularly with regards to a terribly scary condition like Alzheimer's disease. You know, the vision at the end of the Human Genome Project was, we're going to find the genes for these traits. We're going to then know the cause of them. And then that's going to pave the way for all sorts of biomedical interventions to make these problems go away so that we don't have to face those scary realities that some patients may be facing. Alzheimer's disease is just a classic example of one where there are some genes that are known to increase the risk of having it. But treatments for it have largely been wanting. You know, there is no cure for Alzheimer's disease yet. And so we are at a really awkward place now with some of these traits where genetic sources of the problems have been found, but then interventions that are supposed to make them go away are not available. And that creates the kind of problem that Will was just describing, where you might find yourself in a situation where you're torn about whether or not to get this information, because it's not like getting it will necessarily pave the way to a solution. It's just sort of creates the opportunity for all sorts of anxiety about the fact that you could have this thing and not have an obvious route towards preventing it.
Thanks for the call, Will. Talking to James Tabery about his new book, Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Let's go now to Tom in Milwaukee. Hello, Tom.
Hi. I'm wondering if one could extend the question of looking at environmental factors into aspects of political decisions, such as during the Trump administration, a lot of the Environmental Protection Agency's regulations were nullified, or protections for OSHA, for workers. These are political decisions. It's not necessarily a question of where to direct research so much as just maintaining the protections we should already have.
Tom, thanks for the call. Jim, you tackle that in the book. You point out, as Tom does, there's bipartisan disagreement over things like environmental protections and workplace safety. But this personalized medicine, people across the aisle seem to be able to work together on.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I'm so glad that Tom raised that. You know, the subtitle of the book is Personalized Medicine, Its Threat to Public Health. I think that, you know, one of the points I want to make clear is I don't think there's anything necessarily intrinsic to this genomic medicine that threatens public health. Rather, the idea is that there are all these sort of forces at play that are blowing into the wind of the sails of personalized medicine, which simultaneously tend to work against focus on researching public health. And the political landscape that Tom brought up is a perfect example of that. When you look at focusing on the environment and environmental research generally, environmental health, the environmental contributions to health and illness, it is a very politicized phenomenon, right? I mean, you've got one political party where people that are trying to run for president are vowing to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency. I mean, that's sort of how politicized it's become. And so it's a hot button issue. When you switch over to personalized medicine, genomic medicine, precision medicine, blue, red, you name it, across the political spectrum, political leaders love the idea of launching an initiative where they're promising to cure cancer or make kids with rare diseases live longer lives. It's one of those things that in our very polarized day and age is a place where Democrats and Republicans tend to unite. And so that's another one of these reasons that you can see all this attention and effort going into it, is because it's a spot where the political tension just isn't as fraught as it is on the environmental side.
Tom, thanks for that call. And Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's James Tabry, professor in the Department of Philosophy and member of the Center for Health, Ethics, Arts, and Humanities at the University of Utah. Talk to him today about his new book. It's called Tyranny of the Gene, Personalized Medicine and Its Threat to Public Health. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, alcohol is a big part of Wisconsin culture and a major health hazard here in the state. We'll find out why Wisconsin stands out among states for high rates of drinking and of alcohol-related injuries, illnesses, and deaths. You can join already with your thoughts right now on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email ideas@WPR.org. Why do you think Wisconsin has such a strong alcohol culture? If you've moved here from another place, what stood out to you? Do you have solutions in mind? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. Also tomorrow, a new documentary highlights endometriosis, a painful condition that often goes undiagnosed for the women dealing with it. We'll meet the filmmaker behind the project and also talk to a medical expert here in the state. And as always, you can join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a photographer whose new collection tells the story of life in rural Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around, there's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.